So, we're ready to roll here. Okay, let's roll through the... Welcome to everybody who's here. We're glad you're able to make it. We're real excited about what we're going to be dealing with today. The part that's not quite so exciting, perhaps, for some, really exciting for others, is the approval of the agenda. We agreed on what we're going to be talking about?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, approval of minutes. You've seen them.
I move to approve.
Okay, second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Let's move through the things here. Time banking committee update. Karen?
I don't have a whole lot of updates since... last month. The one thing that is new is that the project can now accept money, donation. Yay! Anybody out there that wants to write a check, we would love it. What we're going to be doing is if someone donates to the time banking project, the check is made out to the Human Services Council / time banking. And that's the way that will be handled, and that was kind of up in the air, and we weren't sure how we were going to do that last time. So that's the only new news this month. And if any of you are interested in knowing more about time banking, please contact the Commission on Aging. I'll be glad to give you more information than you ever dreamed was possible.
Can we put that on our income tax? The donation?
If you want it as a donation.
It's tax deductible.
Yes, that can be done. You need to indicate that at the time that you're giving a check so that that's known and the Human Services Council will generate a letter. So.
Okay, Patty, mental illness committee update?
Well, I'd like to call it mental health instead of mental illness.
Mental health committee update.
And we had a very enthusiastic meeting. I don't have much to report, but it was a good meeting.
There has been lots generated in the newspaper over the last couple of months.
And there's a lot going on at the state level that needs to kind of filter down to the county level, and we'll be doing so in the next couple of months.
It's really been encouraging, though, to see the movement that exists in that area. Great. Okay, Senior Ward Committee, Lisa was not able to be here today. Senior Job Fair update, just to know that it's going forward. I'm yet to meet with Pam. Her schedule has not permitted that, but it is going to be happening. It's going to be more than a job fair, however. We'll be having, along the same lines that Jamie Herrera Butler, our Congresswoman, put together for the job fair for the community, we're going to have a day that's specifically designed for people who are probably over 55 and retooling for the job market, jobs that may be available, everything having to do with aging and vocational involvement. So it's going to be really good. Excited to see that. We do not have a date. It's going to be sometime between April and September. That's how close they are on that. It's Jamie Herrera Butler's call on that. It's what they determine. And we are helping in the process. We already talked about the Neighborhood Association work update. Marjorie, you have a communications update.
Thank you, Bill. I'll just read it in the interest of efficiency. As you might recall, I'm new to the communication part on this committee, as well as new to the committee. So, I've been reviewing the database used to send COA messages, such as news releases, and to foster community engagement. I am impressed with the depth and breadth of the database that Colette, Jackie, and Mary Beth have created over the past few years, cultivated, and continue to cultivate. It serves us very well. For example, news releases have already gone out regarding presentations for today's meetings, as well as the COA meeting in March and April. From this database, I will be working with Colette and Jackie to contact specific people and agencies to further strengthen COE's relationships. For example, the Human Services Council, heads of the neighborhoods, groups that Bob was discussing, he and I will be going together. Mm-hmm. Vancouver Housing Authority, newspaper editors, and so forth. The announcement email to the COE-related groups and individual that comes from Mary Beth goes to a database of some 1,000 people, which includes city councils, some 200 or some 300 agencies, and our state and federal legislative delegations. At my request, Colette has scheduled meetings this week for Bob and me to meet with the head of the Vancouver Neighborhood Association and the Neighborhood Associations of Clark County, although one of them has been postponed to a later time. I will be sitting in on the time banking meeting at Human Services Council on Thursday, regular meetings that Karen, Colette, and Jackie have been a part of for quite a while. Also at my request, Colette set up a meeting with Greg Johnson, editor of The Messenger, which we had last week. We are in discussions about a possible insert in the June edition spotlighting the work of the COE. Such a project dovetails nicely with the writing, layout, and printing of the COE annual report. That's it for now.
Do you know that the neighborhood associations have a newsletter that I think we can tag on to? When we talk to the big group, I think we can maybe have a monthly or a weekly newsletter in there.
Okay, thank you very much, Marjorie. We're going to move into our main presentation. We wanted to give as much time as possible for this, and there was a story some of you may have seen in the Oregonian a few weeks ago that spotlighted the Johnsons in Southern Oregon and work that they have done. And as a consequence, we got in touch and asked them if they would come and share with us sometime in the spring. And we were so fortunate that they had today available and had things to do in the area so they could be with us. And they have a whole lot to bring to the table. In terms of background and expertise, and are doing an incredible work where they are that really has all kinds of implications and applications far beyond where they live. And so I'm excited to be able to introduce Sharon and Howard Johnson, age-friendly innovators, one of their hats, among hats. And they probably will tell you more about that. So you're on.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Council on Aging.
There you go.
Commission on Aging.
Here we are. And thank you, members of the commission. We likewise applaud what you're doing up here. We've already taken advantage of it. We managed to con you out of, I don't know how many of your green booklet. A lot of them. I was stunned and pleased because we've been able to put that to very good use, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So, onward. Who are we? This is full disclosure. We tell you our ages. I think that's important. We're going to talk
sure
about
you use the mic so everybody can
hear. I'm sorry, yeah. Sharon is a retired educator. She was with Oregon State University, an associate professor emeritus there. She also has been writing a syndicated columnist in the local newspaper down in Bedford, Oregon for at least 10 years that I know of. She has a certification in gerontology. Both of us are National Association of Home Builders certified aging in place specialists. We took that training in Denver several years ago. We didn't want to start building houses. We don't want to remodel houses, but we thought we wanted to know what it was all about, and that was sort of the start of at least my education in this area. I'm kind of retired. I've been working in marine conservation and fisheries for many, many years. I was a Purpose Rise Fellow some time ago. I blog, Sharon blogs, and I'm the Deputy Director of Age Friendly Innovators, which means I draw a salary of zero, and Sharon is the Executive Director, gets two times zero. That's how that works.
As it should be.
We are a 501c3 nonprofit founded in November 2013. We have a 5-member board. I won't go into detail, but they're all very qualified, talented people including a gerontologist from the Portland area. Our mission is to promote greater awareness of aging in place issues and develop creative and innovative solutions to enable older adults to lead safe, healthy, and independent lives and a home of their own. In other words, we're all about education and outreach.
And we want to share just a little bit about the projects that we've got going on right now. We have a website that we manage ourselves. It's a WordPress website. We heard you earlier mentioning the website. And you can go there, www.agefriendlyinnovators.org. The projects that you will see displayed graphically there include a large grant that we got from the state, from Oregon, to collaborate, to work with our area agency on aging to do some sub-projects, to train realtors and professional builders and people in our community on what is this concept of universal design? What's that all about? We are collaborating with our area agency on aging to develop a marketing plan for that, to develop a website for them, and to look hard at some folks that are really on the edge of falling off the housing spectrum, are not able to hang on to their houses, don't have the money to do it. Are there things that we can do, tools that we can offer that would help them be able to do that? And one of those tools is we have designed a fall reduction, fall risk assessment, and are turning it into an app that would allow us to go into, we've done about 20 of these in paper form, go into homes and look at what's in the environment that makes it likely for people to fall. Some of the obvious things, dog toys on the floor, not enough light, extension cords stretching across, throw rugs. So we give them feedback, we give them ideas, we give them recommendations, we call them up 2 weeks later, see if we've done that. We call them up 6 weeks later. We make as sure as we can, we want to find out if people can reduce the likelihood they can fall. Because it's a part of home of your own aging in place is don't fall, fracture, end up in a hospital, the emergency ward. And then our probably favorite project, we're trying to corral ourselves because we're very impatient, we have a lot of good ideas, is an intergenerational park. We've got a donation of 2.2 acres of land, and we are setting up what in Europe is called a grandparents park. And it's got a lot of features to it that make the generations come together. So that's our sort of the wheelhouse that we're operating in right now.
So what we really want to talk about today, you know, what's it all about, Sharon just said, is really the goal, I think, for all of us really, at least from our perspective, is really aging in place, which is defined in various ways, but essentially is the ability to live in one's own home and community safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age, income, or ability level. That's pretty much the standard aging in place definition. The process, in my view, to get to that aging in place is by adopting, promoting, understanding universal design, which really is design of products and environments that are usable by all people to the greatest extent possible without the need for adaptation of specialized design. Now, we'll show you some examples. That sounds maybe a little convoluted, but it really is making things that everybody can use regardless of their age. The yardstick that we're using in Southern Oregon to measure the success we're having in getting people to adopt aging in place and utilize universal design is something called Lifelong Housing Certification Standard. And we'll talk more about that. The problem that we really face, I think all of us, and some of you may have seen this slide before, is really that and we've seen this for the last 2 years at least. Most homes are what are called Peter Pan housing, designed for people who are never getting old, and they have stairs, but they're never going to fall down. They often have inaccessible bathrooms, inadequate light. They don't have necessarily safety features that will help them avoid falls. They're living in a constant state of denial. There's that song, "I'm going to live till I die." Well, sometimes things happen in between live and die that change the housing situation.
So just briefly, the demographics of aging, you wouldn't have established this commission unless you understood those well. But what we say that always gets people's attention is every day, every single day, 10,000 people in the United States turn 65. And that trend will continue for the next 19 years. That's huge. That's like, people call it the tsunami, the tidal wave. We don't want them to call it something negative. We think it's opportunity. We think it's worth looking at harder. We think the impacts, obviously, there will be an increased demand. At some point, people, the tipping point will come, and people will recognize that we need age-friendly living, or we're going to end up where nobody wants to be. I don't want to live in a nursing home at 85. How do we do avoid that? What do we do with people and for people in collaboration with people to avoid that? Increased demand for alternative housing models, whether that's co-housing, which I think you talk about here, whether it's accessory dwelling units. We developed a concept that we want to push forward called nested neighborhoods. We have in the valley where we come from something called Ashland at Home, which is a concierge service for helping people stay in their home, age in place. Increased demand for caregivers. We're all going to, at some point in time, ask the question, who in this room is a caregiver? And lots of hands will go up. And to those who didn't, I would say, you will be. Because caregiving and care receiving is part of how we age. We're going to age and live a whole lot longer. And in that process, we're going to have a lot of demands for increased products, different kinds of things that make life easier than it was when we were 20, 30, or 40.
And we're going to come back to that products a couple times later on. This next slide is pretty intimidating, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on. This is called a bubble graph. For those that you've never seen one, really what it's trying to depict is the cost versus the level of care and supervision in terms of senior living. And so obviously the less care required, the lower the cost, the higher and the essentially that lower care and supervision implies that you are in your own home. As you go up to the very top, that's continuing care. We have a facility in Southern Oregon called the Manor. There's a very expensive buy-in and monthly fees and so forth. But once you're there, they take care of you basically for the rest of your life. And then you've got all of these other things, assisted living and so on and so forth. One of the things we noted, Sharon and I, when we were looking at that, is my mother was actually in an adult foster home here in Vancouver when she passed away. That was the only option we had at that time, but it turned out to be very, very wonderful, and the people did a wonderful job. So there are many more different options, but these are some of the major ones. The reason we talk about that is because these various options have costs associated with them. Assisted living in our valley down in Medford, $4,600 a month. The Portland area is $3,800. I suspect that there's a figure for Vancouver. I didn't have a chance to pull it up. But the Genworth 2014 cost of care survey covers every state and most major metropolitan areas. So if you're interested in this data, it's up there. So I'm in that Genworth report. And you can see, you can run the numbers on nursing homes, so with private or semi-private rooms, adult daycare, so on and so forth. The reason we put that up there is when you start to analyze your options, those alternatives come into play in terms of economics.
And those alternatives, it might be interesting to know, there's a Harvard University study that is very comprehensive, that we could certainly send it to anyone who would like to see it. But it says 5 most important features in any home in aging in place are no step entries, extra wide hallways, living spaces on the ground floor, accessible light switches, and door levers. You notice they don't mention accessible bathrooms. But those 5 areas are found by Harvard to be the most important, and only 1% of the housing units in America have all 5 of those features. Bathrooms, again, aren't even factored into that. So we've got a big, big challenge here. The challenge in part can be met through things that are, I sometimes say, the kinds of things that lazy, able-bodied people like lever door handles that you can open with your arm, grab bars. They don't have to look like grab bars in bathrooms. They can look like towel racks. In our kitchen, that lower picture is a drawer where instead of having cupboards, we have a lot of drawers. You can put drawers down so you don't have to reach up and take up a big pile of plates out drop on your asphalt. And then my favorite universal design, these are just a few examples, there are many, is the bottom picture there is a toilet roll holder. You know, the kind of spiral rollers, holders that pop out and you're always stretching around with it. These are just one, put it on, easily take it off, easily. Simple things that can make a big difference.
So, we titled this presentation, Should We Stay or Should We Go? And really, that's a decision that's going to be made more and more as this number of people get older, the baby boomers and so forth. So some of the factors that weigh into that decision, in our view, and I'm sure there's a lot more, but you know, will the current home meet your future needs? Now, here's where people refuse to think about the future in many cases. They just can't bring themselves to think about what might happen and what needs might change to precipitate doing something differently. But those future needs could include accessibility, they could include mitigating fall risk. I mean, we've had our former home, I'll show you, had stairs all over the place, and it just was, you know, you have a major fall risk. And also future maintenance is a big factor. But a lot of people, the vast majority of people, according to surveys like AARP, they want to stay in their own community, and indeed, most of them want to, in a survey, will say they want to stay in their own home. They don't want to go anywhere. So you have to look at the remodel cost versus alternative cost, and also alternative living options. And that's where those previous charts, where you have to begin to understand what, you know, what the alternative cost might be to, you know, if you want to stay in that home, what are you going to have to do versus if you're going to go into assisted living, that has costs and so forth. So it can become an economic analysis. So to bring that really close to home, this was our home of 14 years in Jacksonville, Oregon. It was a lovely Victorian style home. It wasn't 8 years old, it was fairly new. It was about 14, 15 years old. But it was built on a hill, it was two-story. It had multiple yard levels, which means it had multiple steps, plus steps to the front porch, steps to the upper yard. In the foyer, the steps to the top floor required you to go up, make a 180, and go up some more steps. And if you've ever done much furniture moving, that's a killer. Let me tell you. Not only that, we had a bedroom suit. We couldn't even get up there. We had to get rid of it. And finally, the kitchen was narrow, and that was always troublesome to us because we like to entertain, and you know, people like to congregate in the kitchen. It was just really crowded. So we did that analysis and that evaluation.
And our decision is, we brought somebody in to look at our house. We loved our house. And says, what can we do? We were even entertaining, until we heard the cost of an elevator. He said, there's no place in this house for an elevator. So our decision, why we decided to move, is we couldn't remodel for accessibility because the value of your house will drop dramatically. Yard maintenance, we're late 60s, early 70s, that tiered yard wasn't going to work. Future upkeep, keep thinking about what's going to happen as we age. And because we wanted to walk the talk, not just walk the talk. We talked about this stuff, we thought about this stuff, and we needed to do something about it. We were going to keep that energy. And peace of mind is like the wrong kind of peace there, but it took a piece of both of our minds. It kind of took a lot of dialogue.
She's always giving me a piece of her mind. So
that's why she's number one.
So what we did, and I'm not sure the process.
Well, we opted to build a home. We looked around for remodel opportunities. We simply couldn't find what we were looking for. At this point, I want to say something that about our home and the process we're going through in our nonprofit. we have made this home that we built, and I'll describe it a little more here in just a second. We realized that in terms of walking the walk, we were building a home that not everybody could fit that. That this is bigger, it has a few more bells and whistles. But we did that because we wanted to be able to bring people into our home and show them not how spacious and wonderful our home was, but what a accessible home could look like. And it doesn't have to be this big. It you can make them smaller, but those universal design elements, the open concept floor plan, all of those things you can put into a smaller home. And I'll show you some examples here in a minute. But we thought, why don't we do this? We've had 150 or 200 people come through our home already. It gets a little crazy at times, but really that was our commitment. People, builders, realtors, whoever, want to see this home and see what it looks like, we'll throw it open. So this home is single story, no step entry, very open floor plan, you'll see it in a minute. Every door in the home is 36 inches wide, and there's not a single step anywhere in the house. All the bathrooms are accessible. It has ADA appliances, which is not required by the lifelong housing standard, but we just wanted to go a little bit extra to show what that really meant. All the handles are levered handles throughout the house, including the kitchen and bathroom and fixtures. And we did have that house certified to the lifelong housing standard, which we'll talk more about here in a minute. This is one of the features that I really like. This is a wheelchair accessible walkway from the sidewalk. It's at a slope that allows for wheelchairs to easily make it up and into the house. There's a no step entry, a very less than half inch threshold. We have people come in and they walk in and they're in the house, and I say, well, what do you think of that wheelchair ramp? And they kind of pause and they look, and I say, well, that's essentially what it is. The wheelchair ramp doesn't have to look any different than anything else if you're able to do it on that. As we said, it's a no-step entry, very low threshold, and very easy, 36-inch door, and easy to get into. This is the open floor plan. Again, the kitchen is right there. There's a dining sort of alcove, but lots of room to move around, and it's very, very maneuverable. The hallways run from 42 to 52 inches wide. I think the minimum required is 36 inches, but if you really want to move around and go around a corner, not the wider hallways are preferred.
And the fully accessible kitchen, we have a concept that we haven't implemented in any way, but we think about a lot, and that's the kitchen as a health center. You know, how can you, obviously having counter space that allows, and a little, as you see at the end, a little flip down shelf that if we're in the kitchen, like one of our friends who's in a walker or wheelchair likes to sit, they can cook with us. There's lots of light. Older eyes need 3 to 4 times the light that young eyes do. So the light, we can have light meter on our iPhone so we can keep checking that. What it is it's the kind of kitchen that is, it helps you think maybe about more nutrient-dense eating because you're just kind of around it all the time. The refrigerator, even 80-inch refrigerators, when you open them up, they're very, very bright inside. So you can see all your vegetables and all your fruits, and kind of leads you in the right direction. There's a accessible bathroom, guest bathroom. We, as we were building it, we had to ask them to tear out a wall and a vanity and put in the pedestal sink because, again, if we want it to be fully available to anybody that comes to our home, it has to be bigger, has to have the turn to make us.
So we've mentioned the couple times the Rogue Valley Council government's lifelong housing standard and lifelong housing certification. And how we came to get involved in this is kind of an interesting story because when we made the decision that our home was not going to work for us, we went looking for models, homes that we desired, an accessible home. And there weren't any. Builders weren't building any. We wanted to be on level ground. We simply couldn't find a home that was ready, move-in ready, if you will. And so we heard about this lifelong housing standard. We went to the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, and
which is the area agency on aging in our head.
And we said, tell us about the lifelong housing standard. And they did. They showed us the checklist and so on and so forth. And we said, where can we see one? And they kind of said, well, nobody's built one yet. Okay. So but we went home and we thought about that, and we thought about that, and we said, well, maybe we should try to do something about that. So we embarked on a process. We found a builder, and we collaborated with that builder, and we said, look, we want to build some age-friendly homes. Not for ourselves. We want to build some that will test this concept that you can build an accessible home and they sell. Builders were fearful they'd build a home that was accessible, nobody want to buy it for some reason. Couldn't figure that one out, but that's exactly what happened. So we embarked on a bit of an adventure with the lifelong housing standard, and we made a partnership with a builder in Southern Oregon called W.L. Moore. They had a housing a development that had been underway, and then it throttled back with the recession, and they were just starting to kind of ramp up again. This is about two plus years ago. And so we finally did a deal with them to build up to four houses to this lifelong housing standard. First ones in all of Oregon that would meet that standard. This is what we call house number one, this picture here. That's Sharon on the right. A gentleman named Andre Stevenson from Kohler in the middle, and the builder, Brett Moore, on the left. And what's going on in this picture was we contacted Kohler and told them what we're doing, and we said, we'd like to talk to you about it and see what, because in fact, Kohler had two catalogs. They're the plumbing fixture people, I think most people realize that, out of Wisconsin. They had two special catalogs. They had an ADA, Americans with Disability Act catalog. They also had an aging in place catalog. So when I saw that catalog, I said, yeah, these guys get it. So lo and behold, Andre came down. He's based in Portland. He came down, and we did a walkthrough with the builder and with Andre and Sharon and I. And near the end, we're looking over the floor plan, and Andre says, so he looks around, he said, okay, I like it. Kohler will donate all the plumbing fixtures for the first house. All the plumbing fixtures, including aging in place, accessible shower stalls, comfort height toilets, as they call them. And if you don't know what a comfort height toilet is, you ought to go try one. believe me. So they donated, they told the builder, okay, just go to the local plumbing distributor and pick out what you want. So we got everything, including the kitchen sink, for that first house. And you could have knocked us over with a feather, because we really didn't know we were asking, if we were even asking for anything. There was no contract. It was all a shake of the hand. But that's a sign that some of these progressive companies like Kohler, they get it. They understand that this is a market that's going to grow. And so keep that in mind as you branch out or looking for support out there. So the certification has three levels in Southern Oregon, the lifelong housing standard. The first one is simply basic accessibility. This is often called visitability. I think that's another term you hear. And simply means that visitors can get in your house. If they're in a wheelchair, they can, that sounds like a simple thing, but it's not. The door is wide enough that there aren't steps that are barriers. There's at least a no-step entry somewhere. Maybe it's in the garage, but there's got to be one way into the house that's accessible. Short story there, we had a meeting with the local home builders association, and one of the party from in our committee at the lifelong housing committee was in a wheelchair. We got to the home builders association office in Medford, and it was not accessible, which kind of was not a big surprise, but that's kind of where at least home builders in the valley are right now. The fully accessible level two, which is what we did with the homes we built and the home we built for ourselves, they are fully accessible on the ground floor. You can't have a two-story home. You just use the second story, as most of you well know, and your fine booklet points out, you could have a second story that is used for other people or whatever, but the ground floor has at least one fully accessible bedroom, bathroom, and kitchen. Enhanced accessibility is really for unique situations where special equipment is required, like a weight lift or special construction or things like that. So by and large, the standard that we're shooting for with all the work we do in collaboration with Rogue Valley Council of Governments and the outreach of the community is to get as many homes in the valley at level two. And that includes not only new construction, but certainly remodel, which ultimately is the bigger market by far. This is a sign that when we started the project, we put out there in this development. It's called Twin Creeks. It's in Central Point, which is just north of Medford, right off Interstate 5. You can see we put the Kohler logo up there, and along with AARP and the builder and so forth. Funny thing is, we built a bunch of these homes. They all sold very quickly. So we built our home, and of course that was pre-sold because that was our home. Somebody wanted to build next door, and they said, we'll go in on lifelong housing. So we have six of these homes, and so I went to that are under construction or done and sold. So I went to the builder and I said, Brett, okay, you know, we're done. We've done what we said we were going to do. Can we take down the sign? And he said, hell no. I want to build more of these. So the sign is still up there, but people come in, they say, you know, where can I see one? Well, they have to send them to us because they haven't built any more. But they're going to. They're actually going to build 19 more.
Tell them how they're selling compared to the other ones, the traditional ones.
Well, that's my next slide.
And here at the four homes that we built before we built ours, the first three lifelong housing certified homes have that 1652 to 1788 square feet. They sold for 171 per square foot. Across the street, the homes that were not lifelong housing certified, were not universal design, were not very accessible, didn't have much light, are still on the market. For us and for the builder, that was like a blinking green light that said, let's keep doing this, let's do more of it. And it's probably what took us in the direction of this innovations grant from the state. It's prompted local foundations in our area to be very interested in what we're doing in other arenas, which we like. And AARP Oregon is just our best friend. They just love this, they embrace this. They will be a part of a symposium that we're having in May on the 16th, and we would invite anybody to get a bus, come on down. We'd love to show you these and have you listen to a woman, Susan Duncan, who's here from Arizona, who's just an incredible presenter on home occupation.
I just want to say a little bit more about these four homes. People that bought them, I heard, I think that you, Bob, was talking about it, some homes were being built here 205. These homes could be ideal for a young family starting out. You know, having a no-step entry is pretty nice if you're kind of pushing a stroller, a baby stroller across, or carrying in a load of groceries and you want to pull the door with your arm. That your arm is easy to do. So these homes were purchased, the farm one was purchased by an 81-year-old woman who's, has no discernible disability. She's very active, very charming woman. She's into, weaving, is a womb. The second home, coming, these are hard to see, but the second one was purchased by a 91-year-old man, again, very active, but the home he left was a fall trip hazard from the get-go. Terrible, had steps in all different directions. So it was just, and he's thrilled to be in that home. The one next to him was older, a couple probably in their early 70s. He has a little bit of maybe early dementia, but the woman wanted to get out of their large, very large home into something more manageable in case something did happen. But again, they're, you know, he walks the dog, they do all the things that normal people do. And the final home on the right, those people are in their 50s, they bought it just because they liked it. And they didn't even realize at first that it was accessible and lifelong housing certified. And the thing we like about them is he's the deputy chief of police from Medford. And he parks the police car right in front of our house. Now, here's one of my favorite slides. Imagine, if you will, you go into Toys R Us and they've got a Barbie aging in place remodel dream house. So they've taken their dream house and they've reworked it. So what does it look like? It's adapted for the main floor living. Widened doorways, things that we've already talked about, installing handheld shower head and grab bars, lever handles and plumbing fixtures, and dear old Barbie uses a comfort hike toilet. Don't ask me what happened to Ken. I don't really know, but Barbie's aging in place like we all are in the moment.
So we're going to close this and do questions here, but we have identified up here what for us have been the lessons that we've learned. And some of them are really fresh because we just came off 2 weeks of workshops that we did in our demonstration home that had realtors and builders and architects and one financial planner. And we gave them 3 hours worth of information about universal design, tour of the house, lots of good food, and we were trying to persuade them, push them in the direction of universal design. What we found, I reinforced, we've done focus groups a couple of times, that older homeowners are in definite denial. They do think, the stairs help me keep exercising. They have all sorts of reasons, but they're unwilling to plan for aging in place. So when we think about how we market this, we thought about, is it a pull strategy where you grab people, consumers or builders, and pull them into it, or is it a push strategy where you push the consumers to the builders and make them ask for what they want? What we also found is that remodeling for accessibility is an economic challenge for older homeowners, absolutely. So one of our newest envisionings is that we want to collaborate with someone, another builders, maybe in our area. Let's find a home, hidden gems is what we call them, old home in the community, and let's remodel that with some of the things, not a lot of bells and whistles, but create a demonstration home so people can see, well, this is what it takes, cost-wise, in all ways, to get a bathroom door wired so you can get in there if you need to in a wheelchair. And what we found finally is, not surprisingly, is realtors were pretty interested in this stuff. Builders, not so much. We made all the people attending our workshop complete an action plan. They had to commit to doing something. And we were going to check on them and whether they did it or not. And we did actually have one builder say, I will build an atrium home in Grove Valley in the next year. But getting builders to the table is very, very hard. They're easily selling what they currently build, and they're just not aware of this demographic tidal wave, if you will. We've got work to do in that area.
So with that, I think if we have time, Bill, for a few questions, we have
please, that was so fabulous. Let's have questions.
That we have is the height of the electrical outlets is raised up to about 18 to 20 inches. And the reason, of course, is if you're in a wheelchair, you don't want to have to reach all the way down there where builders have been putting the outlets for, and nobody knows why. You ask them why they do it, they say, most people will say, well, it's because it was the height of a hammer. I have no idea.
In your bedroom, you have them higher than that, don't you, in your nightstands or something?
Well, yeah, that was unique. The next door bed, we even had them higher so that if you're in there, you know, we got all these things we plug in now, chargers for the Kindle and the phone. So I want them right next to me in the bed. I didn't have to hunt for them. The controls on the, for like the thermostat and so forth are higher. higher or lower?
Lower.
Yeah, right, lower, sorry. So all those things are done in the interest of again, it's sort of common in universal design.
And the windows are, as you saw when you saw the picture of our house, are bigger, wider, deeper, lower. So someone who wants to stay seated can easily look out the window. They don't have, and they open with, went through the house, make sure that everything, appliances, faucets, windows could be opened with a closed fist or one finger.
Like us on Facebook. Please.
Pardon my cold. But what are some other things that you're finding that builders are struggling with making the change?
Well, I think it's, you know, the obvious fear is I'll build it, but nobody will buy it. Unless, so we have builders that build the development, and they're all sort of cookie cutter, okay? Because they know they can sell those. And even though, you know, I think that walkway is gorgeous.
Yeah.
But builders, oh no, people want steps. Even when they don't need steps, they force them to buy all the steps. Now, how goofy is that? And I don't know how many of you went to the Lake Oswego, what do they call it, Spirit of Dreams, a couple of years ago, there were 9 homes there. There were like 600,000 to 2 million or something. 9 homes, not a single one of those was accessible. That's the problem. There's a mindset that has to change.
Maybe you should make the builders bring their moms.
That's so right. When you talk to people, everybody has a grandmother or a mother story. Somebody fell and broke her hip and they couldn't get back in their house. My sister's here in the audience. We had a similar situation with our mother. Everybody has those stories. You're absolutely right.
But I have a good story. My friend's mother-in-law could not get into their home. So he decided that all steps should be only 4 inches high. And that I have all my back stairs and my front ramp, but he built all that stuff and it worked great.
I'm Peggy McCarthy from National Alliance on Mental Illness. Many of the people that we work with, because of the medications they take, gain huge amounts of weight. And so we have several people in our office who have not only heavy wheelchairs, but their body weight adds to that, so that the combined weight is probably 500 to 600 pounds. And one of the things that we found, because we just started a new lease, is that the toilets, number one, they were regular toilets. We replaced them with the higher toilets. But they're not strong enough to hold that weight. No. So we now have to add extra strong toilets, but the toilets are placed out from the walls. So we had a couple of cracked toilet tanks, because when somebody leans back against the toilet and there's a space between the toilet tank and the wall, that allows the toilet, whatever the toilet tank is on, to flex and it breaks the tank. So we've now put a block behind the toilet tanks. And I just wondered if you've thought about anything like that and how you're handling those things in the bathroom.
You know, that's interesting. I don't think that's come up with the standard that is out there.
I haven't ever seen it in the standard.
What we have done, and the builder is doing that we work with, is they do some provisions. For example, not everybody wants to have grab bars right away. But if you're building or remodeling, you can put what they call backing. So
yes.
You can reinforce the bathroom so that if there's a need later on, either for grab bars or perhaps a, you call that a barrier?
If we ever built our own place, we will put lots of girders in the bathrooms just to support that weight, because it's a lot of weight at one time in one place. It's not the rolling weight.
No, that's not it. No,
but
that's
it's just a
right,
something
right.
to think about that you may want to see if they'll include.
Another thing I might add that our builder had never done before, he did at our request, was put an outlet in the bathroom. And
by the toilet.
A plug-in at the toilet. and because we requested a bidet or a bio bidet, and for urinary tract infections in older adult women, it's just so important. And I have in the back of my mind the 19 little cottages that are going up. Our builder is building them, and he is putting a plug in the back of the toilet in every single one. So there's opportunity to do a little bit of examination. What happens here with UTIs, yes, and what happens over here when there's no
bio? UTIs are just
Obviously, one of the challenges because every disabled person is different. For me, I hate raised toilets because I want to transfer straight across. I don't want to have to get up onto something. And it's more difficult to take care of things without, whatever. But anyway, they don't work for me. And a lot of, I've been in different apartments that I don't want the ADA apartment because they cut out the bottom cupboards and then I can't reach any cupboards. So there's a lot of things. I had one that had great bathroom but no place for a washer and dryer. So then I have to take my washer and laundry out, up the way to do it, which is, not easy to do, again, in a wheelchair. So that is one of the challenges, that not everybody's going to need the same things, but also I think they need to rethink some of the ADA standards, because ADA apartments were never helpful for me.
Of course, the houses are not to the ADA standard. They're somewhat different in a lot of areas.
But you're very wise to remind us that every individual is very individual, and we, love different things. If we pursue this remodeling direction or pursue collaboration with folks who are doing some public housing in Medford, those are important things to think about.
Other questions?
I'm not sure. We can talk about that next. Okay. I'm not sure if this was an issue in Oregon because I know a little bit about it. I'm a contractor in Washington State, and I have my company's been improving homes for people with disabilities and seniors for about 6 years. We in Clark County have a lot of two-story homes, especially on the east side, and the newer homes are mostly two-story. We are having a heck of a time trying to figure out how to get the chairlifts onto the stairs in a reasonable amount of time. I work with a DME company called Northwest Safety and Health up on St. James. They say there's a 2 to 4 month waiting time to find a contractor to install a stairlift upstairs or a one level lift, wheelchair lift. And they say their customers are just not going for it because they can't wait, and it's just not worth the hassle. I've done some research today when I knew I was coming here, and I think we only have 2 contractors with elevator licenses. In Washington, Oregon has an exemption for those types of elevators. Washington, you have to have a elevator license, which is the same as a commercial license for like a 90-story building.
Oh,
to put
goodness.
Up. So you have 1,200 or 1,500 hours of apprentice work.
Oh my goodness.
And my little company can't spend 1,200 hours on elevators alone. We do the ramps, we do the grab bars, we run back and forth. I was just thinking about this when we're dealing with somebody who's heavier and we're replacing her toilet seat all the time because she's breaking it. And we don't have time to get, and we can't subcontract with the other guys because they're the guys that are too busy. So I'm in a bind. I talked to LNI today. They're the ones that are covering these licenses, but this is a real problem for Clark County. I don't know if you have an answer. I'm just kind of raising it to the commission as a real problem for Clark County and other Washington counties.
I really don't have an answer except to say, there are all these things that need to be brought to the attention of, the code people, the planners, because a lot of them are frankly young and yeah. most don't get it yet.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, and that's not just one other that I was thinking of. The other generation, I mean, I've got in-laws that are in denial. Well, one's in dementia, living in another world, but his wife, my mother-in-law, is in denial. She's 50. She's a 78-year-old, but she thinks she's 50. And I'm in this place where I want to retrofit her home. And it's one of those places, it's a split level, too many stairs, too much slope. 40 years in that house, it's going to be tough. The kids, I think, might not be in denial because we really care about them. And is that a great marketing place to try to reach?
Well, it yes and no. I mean, it can create tension because, what you just said, the person's been there for 40 years and they don't want the kids telling them what to do. The kids are worried, basically that person in that home you described is one fall away from serious trouble. And that may cause her not to be able to get back into that home the way it is. So it's all about, I think, education for both. And what we try and do, I know we're running out of time here, is promote this idea of universal design as a better living by design, open, and it kind of, and you don't talk so much about aging, you just talk about what else you need.
And I might add that we learned early on that having people come to our home was the way to learn. I mean, people are experiential learners. Older adults learn by modeling, and just to know that you could change it afterward, that you could get into your front house with a lever to handle, that they do exist. That's made a huge difference in some people's minds.
We're going to drop a surprise on that. We're looking at a design for an in-law cottage. We need to redo our garage anyway, and we're going to do something. We're investing in some plants, and maybe that then would also be a place where we could show.
Tell them what you did in the, I just read that article about it, in your bathroom with that cabinet that's removable and so forth. That's a stellar concept.
In both, and that it's not really that novel, but it and we don't use it yet in the way it could be used. But in both our master bath, one vanity, and the kitchen, the cabinet can come out entirely, so a wheelchair user could, especially if they had a wheelchair that had some elevation potential to it, could more easily operate in the kitchen. Throughout the house, there are just little and big things, some of which we've mentioned today, and some of which we haven't. That people do a little aha, and it works sometimes for them, and other times it doesn't.
Like your floor lighting and some of that kind of stuff.
We didn't go to floor lighting. We did over install lighting.
Yeah.
Everybody's get older. So we have plenty of lighting. We did put in occupancy sensor switches, which are really convenient if you haven't tried those. So you go into a room that, like a closet. Walk-in closet, let's say, the light goes on, and without doing anything, also in our utility room, same thing, the light goes on, and you leave it there for a few minutes, the light goes off. Those are really turning out to be convenient. But lighting and, emergency lighting, we've got provisions for that, and night lights, we're still working on it.
Okay, it's time is up, and can you remain for a little bit? Because there will be a lot of people who I'm sure will want to get with you and ask questions. Colette, did you want to say something about the brochure?
Yes, the Commission on Aging has put together kind of an information guide, so please pick one out at the back and lay out. It'll kind of help you, especially if you need to share with others that you love and would hope that they would pay attention. So it's also online if you need a PDF copy.
One more time, on behalf of the Commission, we just want to thank you so, so much for giving us your time. With that, the meeting is adjourned. What else do we have?
I just wanted to say
that. I forgot that. Okay, bylaw draft change, text change, we all know what it is. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
A quick announcement. I see some of you today were trying to take pictures of this presentation. I will post that on our website, on the community planning/aging website.
so you'll be able to.
Boy, that was good.
Oh, yeah.
I had to stand put together that calendar of upcoming things.
Okay. Thank you. That was fabulous. Wasn't that terrific? Oh, man. Yeah. Wise.
There was a media availability here.
Well, you could do a really good article for the Messenger.
Well, I think in terms of there's more than that, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And actually, Greg Johnson knows these things. Yeah, I think he's done something else. Yeah,
that
lots of potential.
Oh, that was good. Wasn't that good?
It's important to do the correct and as you did, by the way. We're trying to work.